Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the very first episode of the new year of AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Terry Crosby.
As we're speaking, Andy is away doing more filming for The Human Project, and The Human Project is due to be launched at the conference on March 2nd and 3rd. So be sure to keep your eyes on that. You can go to thehumanproject.ca to learn more about this video resource that we're creating. And if you haven't done so yet, I encourage you to go to apologeticscanada.com and sign up for our upcoming conference. As we've mentioned before, Friday night we're going to have a dialogue between Dr. Andy Bannister and Justin Trottier on the Foundation for Human Rights. Which foundation is better, Christianity or secular humanism? So that we're very much excited about getting that happening.
Tickets are selling fast.
Yep. So make sure you go there, sign up sooner than later. Okay. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case down in Colorado and all that entails for our neighbors down to the south. But in Canada, we've been having our own legal battles going on here. And I've mentioned last week, Trinity Western University Law School, that case is at the Supreme Court of Canada right now. And there is lots of conversation that's been happening around that. So we thought it'd be really great to have Andre Schutten on the line here. He's the Director of Law and Policy and General Legal Counsel at ARPA Canada. Andre, thank you for joining us.
Pleased to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
As we get started, can you tell us a little bit more about ARPA and your role there? What does it mean? What does ARPA do? And what does it mean for you to be the Director of Law and Policy and General Legal Counsel?
Sure. Well, let me first start with an apology. I've got a bit of a bad chest cold. So if you or our listeners hear me hacking up along, my apologies. Hopefully you'll forgive me. What does ARPA stand for? What does it mean? So ARPA Canada, ARPA, stands for the Association for Reformed Political Action. So reformed refers to the theological tradition of the Reformation, and political action is our raison d'être. That's our reason for existing. So we have a twofold mission. The first part is to educate, equip, and encourage particularly Reformed Christians, though any Christian can certainly make use of us and our resources, but to educate Christians for political action, get them engaged in the political process. And then the second part of our mission is to bring a biblical perspective to our civil government. So our civil government includes not just the legislatures, those who make the laws, but also the executive branch and the judiciary, the judges, the courts, which interpret our laws. And as it relates to TWU, that meant that we were involved in, and I had the honor and privilege of arguing the Trinity Western case as on behalf of ARPA Canada as an intervener.
Great to have you with us, Andre. And just for our listeners, could you just give us an overview of the case that is before the courts right now with the Supreme Court and Trinity Western University?
I understand it's not just one case either.
Yeah, so this is it's probably been one of the most complicated and complex cases for the Supreme Court in a very long time, particularly because it was two different cases that merged together at the Supreme Court. So let's walk it back a number of years. So if we go back 4 years or so, Trinity Western University had put forward a proposal to start the first ever Christian law school in Canada. So there are 22 or 23 law schools currently in Canada, all of them coming out of a secular humanist worldview, and none of a different type of worldview, including the Christian worldview. So this would have been the first different law school in that respect, privately funded, but still producing good, qualified lawyers. That proposal from Trinity Western had been approved by a national body, as well as the BC, the British Columbia Minister of Higher Education. So both official government representatives had rubber stamped it. They had approved it through a rigorous review process and vetting process. And they said, yes, indeed, this law school will produce competent, ethical, good lawyers for the public benefit. After that process, though, law societies in three different provinces, Nova Scotia, Ontario, and British Columbia, said, we don't care that this law school will produce good, competent lawyers. We don't care that two public bodies, the Minister of Higher Education and this national body that reviews new law schools, we don't care that they found that that's the case. We have objections to the fact that Trinity Western holds their members to a community covenant, to a biblical understanding of what it means to live according to the Bible, to live the good life. And they said, in particular, we don't like their definition of human sexuality and how it should be, only done. Human sexuality should be experienced through a husband and wife in a committed marriage, according to Scripture. And so those three provinces decided that they would not recognize graduates from Trinity Western's law school, which is a bit of a problem. And that put the law school on hold for a while. And TWU took those three law societies in those three provinces to court. And they won at the lower courts and at the courts of appeal in British Columbia and in Nova Scotia. But they lost at the lower court and at the Court of Appeal in Ontario. And so only BC and Ontario got appealed to the Supreme Court. But there we had two different answers to the same question from two different courts of appeal. Court of Appeal of British Columbia saying it's absolutely ridiculous, my words, not theirs, that the Law Society would not recognize this law school. And the Court of Appeal in Ontario saying it's completely reasonable that the Law Society in Ontario would not recognize this law school and their graduates. And so that's the question that the Supreme Court of Canada had to wrestle with and sort out.
Now, Trinity Western has been through this before. If we go back to 2001 and the case with the teaching program at Trinity Western, how does that case bear upon this case today in the courts? What are the similarities? What are the differences that you see in that, these two cases?
Yeah. In my opinion, and definitely the opinion of quite a few lawyers on our side, 2001 should be determinative. In fact, that's why the national body that approved Trinity Western's law school proposal a few years ago, that's what they said. They said, look, the Supreme Court's already ruled on this. It's good for diversity, for us to have a diversity of institutions, including religious institutions. So Trinity Western has a right to start a law school and we should approve it, notwithstanding the fact that Trinity Western is definitely not for everybody. It's for a particular set of people. And so I think that the fact that Trinity Western had to fight this battle already back in 2001 and won handily, like the Supreme Court ruled in their favor 8-1, that's a really good solid win not that long ago, you know, less than 15 years before they started this whole process all over again for their law school. So they're quite similar. There are nuanced differences that lawyers can write pages and pages and pages about. But essentially, what's at stake is the exact same thing. Can Canada tolerate deep diversity? Can Canadians handle an institution that might think differently than the majority of Canadians do on issues like sexuality, marriage, and so on?
Mm-hmm. How many of the justices on this Supreme Court were on that case back then? Do you know?
Just one.
The
Chief Justice. Yeah.
Okay. That's what
Chief
I thought.
Justice.
Yeah.
Beverly McLaughlin, yeah.
Right. Okay.
She has since retired, hasn't she, in December?
That's right. So she retired 2 weeks after the Trinity Western hearing. So the rules of the Supreme Court allow her to still participate in the decision when it's released, assuming that it gets released within 6 months of her retirement. So I suspect that we should see a decision from the Supreme Court within 6 months of the hearing, so probably around May of 2018.
Now, I was always curious, just going back one step, we talked about how this – it's not the first time that this has happened. It happened with the School of Education that opened up back in 2001 or around that time. So if this is so determinative, that ruling was so determinative, why is it that the opposing side – obviously, they're doing this because they think they have a chance. So why do they think that?
There's a couple of things. So one is lawyers have very high views of themselves. So they say, well, you know, lawyers are in a special position. They become judges. They're the ones who assist with interpreting the law. And so because of that, we can't tolerate, quote unquote, we can't tolerate discrimination in any institution that's a gateway to the profession. They also argued that the 2001 teacher's case was argued over the question of whether or not there was any evidence that teachers who graduated from that program would then discriminate against LGBTQ students as public school teachers. And they said that here it's a different question altogether. The question is not whether or not Trinity Western graduates from the law school will discriminate against LGBT people as lawyers. In fact, the law societies all admitted that they wouldn't. They said we'd treat everybody fairly. The question instead, they said, is there discrimination happening in the school itself by refusing to accept particular people into their program to begin with at the gateway to the legal profession is their argument. And so they said, regardless of whether or not lawyers will discriminate or not, once they become lawyers, the school itself is discriminating, they said, and therefore that we shouldn't accept it, because to accept the law school is to accept discrimination, and the law societies themselves apparently would be discriminating by simply recognizing this school. Now, ironically, of course, the flip side is absolutely true, and this is what our argument as ARPA was in front of the Supreme Court, was that, well, there is discrimination happening here, and the discrimination that's happening here is by the law societies themselves, who refuse to recognize competent, ethical law students simply because they hold and associate with others who hold to a biblical understanding of marriage. There's the discrimination. It's happening by the law societies, not by Trinity Western.
It's interesting what you said just a moment ago, that the courts have found that the graduates from this law school would not be discriminatory. The question is not whether they're going to be discriminatory, but the question is whether there is discrimination happening in the institution itself. Because one of the objections that I heard over and over again is, if the institution is discriminatory, say, against the LGBTQ community members, can we expect its graduates to be qualified to practice law in our diverse society? But you're saying that our courts are saying that's not the case.
That's right. Not only are the courts not saying it, the law societies themselves, who are fighting Trinity Western, admitted that. Like, they admitted, yeah, you know, we have no concerns that their graduates are going to discriminate. There's no problem there. So in court, at least, that's never been the argument. Although certainly many people in the public, in media and so on, are certainly saying otherwise.
A side question. What is ARPA's role in all of this? I understand that ARPA is there as an intervener. For our listeners, could you explain what an intervener is? And for this case or this set of cases, how many interveners are there?
Right. When two different parties argue a legal case, whether that's at a court of appeal or Supreme Court of Canada, and there's principles in law that go beyond just those two parties, that are going to affect more than just those two parties, then the court will allow, on application, they will allow other third parties to come in front of the court to also make arguments on those big, broad legal questions. So, you know, if Johnny is suing Sally over something and the legal case just involves the two of them, it's not going to really, you know, the case is just about, you know, who hurt who and how much money should be sorted out between the two of them. Well, you're not going to have an intervener in that case because it only affects those two people. But in this case, we're talking about with Trinity Western on one side, two law societies on the other from two different provinces, dealing with a big principle in law about, you know, deep diversity and tolerance of religious difference and discrimination, apparently alleged anyway, against LGBT people, et cetera, these big, broad legal questions. Well, then that's going to impact more than just Trinity Western University and their students. It's going to impact on all of Canada. And so in a case like this, on application, the court will allow third parties, and those third parties are called interveners. And so ARPA Canada was one of 28 different interveners who applied to have the right to present written and oral arguments to the Supreme Court. Initially, the Supreme Court actually only granted that right to 9 of the 28 who applied. ARPA was one of those 9. Mm-hmm. But then in a rather odd turn of events, a few days later, the Chief Justice amended the order and allowed all 28 interveners to be able to make argument. So there are 28 interveners represented in that courtroom, and on average, each intervener had two lawyers representing them. So the Supreme Court was absolutely smack full of, I think there's 68 lawyers in that room that those 2 days for the hearing. It was a bit crazy, unprecedented, I'd say. I'm as far as I know, there's not a single case in the history of the Supreme Court that has had that many lawyers involved for a hearing.
Yeah, I found it really interesting. I was watching the oral hearing, the recording of it rather, after the fact, and I saw just how packed it was. It was just unbelievable. All I saw was lawyers. And
that was a lot of black robes and white ties.
Yeah.
In the background there.
Yeah, typically I would see some, you know, empty seats and maybe some members of the public. It didn't look like there were any members of the public present there at the hearing.
They squeezed a few in the back pew, but yeah, the lawyers spilled out beyond the bar into the public gallery. So I think the first two pews on both sides were full of lawyers as well. So
I guess this kind of goes to show how important this case is for those listeners who might be thinking, okay, well, how does what Trinity does affect me? Could you tell us a little bit about why everybody is so worked up about this? Why is this case so important?
Well, do we have 2 or 3 hours? Or so it's important on a number of different levels, and depending on which lawyer from our side you ask, they're going to probably highlight the things that are most important to them or their constituency, and so on. So I'll very, very briefly touch on a few from some of the other interveners, and then maybe if we have time, we can get into more in depth on some of the arguments that I made. But
right.
So some of the interveners represent Christian charities. There's big implications for Christian charities because if we're saying that you can't associate with a Christian worldview or a biblical understanding of lifestyle with Trinity Western, well, then how, you know, where's the dividing line between a Christian law school and any other higher education? And if no difference between higher education and, you know, what about secondary education or elementary education and so on? So there's a trickle down effect. So big, broad questions about Christian schooling in general, about Christian charities across the country, some of which, most of which receive a public benefit in at least the form of a charitable tax receipt, right? The ability to grant tax receipts. Mm-hmm. So what about them? We see implications for liberty generally. So we see some secular groups intervening on our side as well, saying, look, liberty requires the ability to tolerate difference. So if you don't like Trinity Western, don't go to Trinity Western. You know, like, what's the big deal? Like, if we're going to have liberty, then that also comes with the reality that we're going to have things that are going to offend us and are going to be maybe even hurtful to us, or things that we're not going to like to go to, but we should allow other people to have their freedom to go to, and so on. And then there was groups that represented questions of what does freedom of religion all entail? So to clarify the law on what freedom of religion includes. So for the keen observer, they'll notice that freedom of religion in the past has often been given a very individualistic interpretation. That's been improving a little bit in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in the last few years. But generally speaking, and certainly on the other side of this, most people understand freedom of religion to be purely individualistic. And even many Christians actually, sadly, understand it that way as well, that religion is purely individualistic, that it's just your own personal relationship with God or the divine or your own spirituality. That's all that matters. But a deep understanding of Christian theology recognizes that while Christianity is a personal thing, you have to have a personal saving relationship with your Lord Jesus Christ, there's also a communal aspect to it. There's the communion of saints. There's your local church community that you're supposed to be a living member of. There's obligations to the broader community and so on. All of those things come into play. And that's something that the other side doesn't understand. So when they see Trinity Western University, they can't understand. They have a hard time wrapping their mind around the fact that community aspect, where you're holding each other accountable to a certain higher standard, a biblical standard, that's a very important aspect of religious life. It's a communal aspect. It's not just individualistic. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are at play. And then there's a big question of what is discrimination and what is association, and that's really where I honed in on. So, and we can talk a little bit about that as well. But
yeah, let's move to that submission by you to the Supreme Court. It's 5 minutes long. You pack a punch in that 5 minutes. Just give an overview of your distinction between the association and discrimination.
So it's going to be very important that the Supreme Court, when they make an allegation one way or the other about whether or not Trinity Western discriminates, that they use the law to make that conclusion. And the Ontario Court of Appeal, this is where I say they erred, and I was polite in my presentation to the Supreme Court about that. I would say it was a horrendous oversight on the part of the Ontario Court of Appeal. The Ontario Court of Appeal said in their judgment, they wrote We have no problem finding that Trinity Western University discriminates contrary to Section 15 of the Charter. Section 15 of the Charter guarantees equality before the law and contrary to the Human Rights Code. That's what the Ontario Court of Appeal did. But then there's no actual legal analysis to back up that claim, like none whatsoever. So like it's such a horrible oversight on their part. Like if I did that as a first year law student in my law school constitutional law exam, I would have failed my exam. Like that's how bad of an oversight it is on the part of the Ontario Court of Appeal. Wow. Because if you're going to make an allegation about failing or being in contravention of the charter or of Human Rights Code, you better back that up by doing a legal analysis. Because I say in the courts, I said, and if they had done the legal analysis, they would have had to conclude the opposite, that in fact, Trinity Western did not contravene Section 15 of the Charter nor the Human Rights Code. In fact, Trinity Western benefits from those things, is not held liable to those things. So this is the important distinction between association and discrimination. Discrimination, first of all, there's two kinds. So one is that the government itself is held to a higher standard on discrimination. The government can't discriminate on the basis of religion or on the basis of sex or sexual orientation or race or a few other factors. All of that is guaranteed by the Charter, Section 15. The Charter binds the government. A lot of people don't know that, but the Charter binds the government. It does not bind private citizens. So the Charter is a shield the private citizen holds against actions by the government. So one of the shields the private citizen benefits from is Section 15, which says the government must treat them equally. So it's the government who can't discriminate against Trinity Western. It's the government who can't discriminate against Trinity Western's graduates. Trinity Western is not bound by that same section. Yet many people on the other side argued that it was. But a basic constitutional analysis would say, nope, sorry, Charter does not apply to Trinity Western. They only benefit from it. They're not held to it. Hmm. So discrimination says, you know, we'll accept all kinds of people for any reason or no reason, except for that guy over there or this guy over there. An example would be if Trinity Western said anyone can come to our university except for Jews. That would be discrimination against Jews because it's targeting one particular race for no reason other than its race. They don't like Jews. Like, because if they're accepting Buddhists and Muslims and atheists and all kinds of different types of Christians, but not Jews, well, then obviously the targeting is because of the Jewish faith or because of the Jewish race. Mm-hmm. That's not the case here. With Trinity Western, they're saying all are welcome. Anyone can come to Trinity Western, but we identify and we're going to run this university around this identity as outlined in our community covenant, which is founded in Scripture. So this is who we are. This is the flagstaff that we're raising. And anyone who wants to join us in this project, you're most welcome. Apply, come, be part of it if you find allegiance to what we're standing for here. Mm-hmm. And so many people do come, mainly evangelical Christians, but there are Muslims and atheists and Buddhists and Jews and even LGBT people will come and attend Trinity Western because they say, you know what? I might not agree with everything in that community covenant, but I recognize that this is an evangelical university and they're going to want to run their university according to that faith tradition. And so even though I'm not part of that faith tradition, I want to associate there, learn there, and benefit there. That is not discrimination. That is called association. They're associating around a religious identity known as evangelical Christianity. And so it's very important to make those distinctions between discrimination and association. And the way to do that is very easy in law is you just do the proper legal tests. There's a test for freedom of association. There's a test in human rights law. There's a test in charter law. And you can do a test for discrimination. But you got to do the test. If you don't do the test, then you're just stuck in hurling accusations across the floor. TW discriminates and, you know, their discrimination hurts so bad and all of this kind of stuff instead of focusing on the law. Like this, we're lawyers and judges. We're supposed to be doing legal tests, not doing, you know, oral semantics about hurt feelings and misapplying labels like discrimination and so on.
Right.
So that's a bit of a rant, but I kind of feel strongly about it.
We can tell.
Yeah. At the end of your submission there, you said the charter is designed to be a shield to protect the freedom of non-government institutions. To argue this, that Section 15 somehow compels the law societies to reject TWU, reforges that shield into a sword to be wielded by the state against TWU. Our Constitution has been described as a living tree, but it is not a mutant organism. It does not have the ability to fundamentally change its essence. The Charter shields TWU. Those are strong words.
Yeah. Here's hoping that they get picked up on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it was almost a stand-up moment in my office at home when I was listening to that.
So just overall, how do you feel about the way this case is going? You know, because I hear some conflicting things. Some people say, oh, you know, this is going so well for Trinity. Others are saying, oh, this is going so well for the Law Society in Ontario, so on and so forth. So from your perspective, how do you think this case is going?
Well, it's bad form for me to predict the outcome, but
right.
like sometimes it's very obvious. So I'll give you one example. The Carter case, so that's the euthanasia case that the mm-hmm. Supreme Court heard a couple of years ago. It was abundantly obvious which way the court was going after that hearing was over. I mean, mm-hmm. it was abundantly obvious within the first half hour of the hearing which way the case was going. I knew, and so did every other lawyer in that room, that we were going to lose the case. The Supreme Court was definitely going to strike down the law on assisted suicide. And the question was going to be, you know, how bad of a decision was it going to be? In this case, it's really hard to know which way it's going to go. There was certainly some judges who understood our concerns. Mm-hmm. And there were certainly judges on that panel who didn't understand our concerns and certainly seemed to favor the concerns raised by the other side. And it was really hard to read, you know, almost all of them. So this is the type of case where I can say that, prayer is needed for every case, but mm-hmm. in particular in this case, not just because of what's at stake, but because it seemed to me that there was enough judges there that hadn't quite made up their minds one way or the other that could possibly be swayed yet in the coming months as they write their decisions. So, I don't know what's going to happen. I guess a decision either way wouldn't really surprise me from where I stand right now. That being said, I don't think it's too much for me to say that if the Supreme Court rules on the law and upholds the law as it is, Trinity Western will win. But if the Supreme Court wants to change the law or more rule according to political will, perhaps, if I can be so bold as to say that, I think Trinity Western will lose. So here's hoping that the law prevails.
Just a question with regards to the decisions in the in Ontario and BC. In BC, the legal regulators said it was inappropriate decision by the BC
Law Society?
Law Society, sorry, yeah. And then while in Ontario, the Law Society's ruling was upheld. So if the decision is in favor of TWU, what happens with these decisions, you know, at a provincial level?
Right. It'll depend on exactly how the Supreme Court words their decision. So a couple of things could happen. One is Supreme Court could say, you guys just handled it wrong. Go back and reconsider and keep these following points in mind and start the whole process over again. That's theoretically possible. It's also possible theoretically for the Supreme Court to say, you guys got it wrong in BC, but you got it right in Ontario. I'd be surprised if they ruled that way, but it's theoretically possible because in BC, there's a bit of a difference in the process, and the process BC really bungled it, whereas the process was a bit more proper, I guess. I mean, it was a wrong decision in my opinion, but it was a better process at least in Ontario. So theoretically, Supreme Court could say, you know, both appeals are upheld. And then it's theoretically possible that the Supreme Court just imposes from the Supreme Court imposes the right answer and says Trinity Western wins. Trinity Western is allowed to open this law school. And so we now order that the Law Society in Ontario and in BC must accept Trinity Western graduates or must recognize the law school, something like that. So any sort of thing, type of thing like that could happen. And that's why even if Trinity Western loses, it could be a really bad loss, or it might be mitigated by depending on how they word their decision. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. And I'm happy to come back on your program if you need me to explain how that comes out.
We'd love to have you back for sure. On a more kind of a broad note, as we come to an end here, because we're running out of time. Apologetics Canada operates out of a local church here in Abbotsford, British Columbia, and denomination-wise, we're a Mennonite Brethren Church, and as you may be aware, the Anabaptists, the Mennonites, have this history of disengaging from politics. And so many congregants here who come from that background are a bit hesitant to get involved in politics. And often the kinds of examples of sort of a poor engagement with politics is brought up, like partisanship, you know, God is a Republican, you know, that sort of a thing. So what would be a word of encouragement to those Christians who are a bit hesitant to get their hands dirty, so to speak, with politics?
So, I would agree with the one example that given that it's not good for us to use the Christian faith in order to promote a particular party or even necessarily a particular candidate. I think that, and that certainly ARPA Canada takes a nonpartisan approach to politics. So we like to talk about the issues, and we will work with any politician, no matter their political background or allegiance, if it advances what is good for Canada. And so I think we need to look for inspiration to examples in the past where that has happened and has happened well, and not be tainted by particularly some distressing trends in the United States where evangelicalism is synonymous or has become synonymous with republicanism, for example. I can understand why that kind of happens south of the border when it comes to certain key issues, but it is unfortunate that they're so tightly wedded. I think that for the Mennonites who would be and other Christians who would be hesitant to get involved in politics, we can look to examples like William Wilberforce, for example, who, because of his evangelical faith, almost single-handedly, though not quite single-handedly, and certainly by the blessing of God, was able to abolish the slave trade in the English Empire, which is a phenomenal feat and something that is so good for all mankind. And so for those Christians who hold a deep faith and understand that Scripture is a good thing, that God's design for society and for our lives is for the good of all, and that when we live according to God's design for society, for family, for government, etc., that's a public good, that is a public benefit there, then we should be inspired to say, then if we can do so, where we can communicate those truths to civil governments as well in winsome ways, then what we're doing is actually we're just putting the command to love your neighbor. We're just putting it into practice in another sphere. So if we love our neighbor as ourselves in the family sphere, that means we're going to treat our children well. If we love our neighbor as ourselves in the sphere of our neighborhoods, that means we're going to love our geographic neighbors well and do well for them. If we're going to love our neighbor as ourselves in the economic sphere, that means we're going to love our employees or our employer and our those who shop and buy our goods and so on. We're going to treat them well with we're going to not steal or lie in our advertisements and so on, right? And so when we go one sphere broader, when we love our neighbor in the political sphere, that means that we're going to advocate for good public policy. And that doesn't mean you have to go door knocking for a particular candidate necessarily, although we would encourage people to do that if they find a candidate that they think can advance good public policy. But that might just mean, you know, engaging with your local representative, your local member of parliament, and say, look, there's this issue that's come up. Let's say, I'll give you an example. ARPA was working a lot last year on the whole issue of pornography. Pornography is a scourge in our society today. Internet pornography now is exposing children in their like 9, 10, 11-year-old children to horrific stuff. It's rewiring their brains literally. So what does it mean for me to love my 11, 12, 13-year-old neighbor across this country? It can mean, among other things, to advocate for the civil government to do something about this issue. Internet pornography and sexual exploitation that's happening is wrecking a lot of kids. So for me to love my neighbor means to advocate for good public policy to maybe make it mandatory for internet filters for youth or something like that. It goes, you know, across all kinds of different issues. And so for any Christian who might be hesitant to be involved in politics, I say check out arpacanada.ca for some of our policy reports on different political issues. And I hope that you can read it with an eye to that lens, that when we see political engagement as a means to love our neighbor as ourselves and to honor God as a sovereign over every aspect of life, then maybe we can get away from that partisan politic that we see south of the border, and we can see a resurgence of Christian engagement politics north of the border.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners, make sure you check out arpacanada.ca to learn more about ARPA is doing and some of the wonderful resources that ARPA has. One thing that I really appreciated about ARPA is the easy mail system. So you can email your local politicians, you know, MPs and MLAs and whatnot, and actually make an impact in that way. Andre, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about this really important case. As we close, how can we pray for you and how can we pray for ARPA?
I'd say two things, perhaps. One is for passion, to continue to persevere. So when you are engaged in politics in today's day and age, there are sometimes disappointments and frustrations. And in order to keep working day by day, to keep advancing good public policy despite, you know, the losses or the failures or the disappointments, to keep going day by day. So passion, I guess. And the second thing would be for courage and conviction, that that we not compromise in order to be appealing to man, but that we can with conviction put forward good public policy that honors God and really does that is really for the benefit of our neighbors. I guess those would be the two things: passion and courage or conviction.
Well, we'll certainly remember you in our prayers. Thank you again for joining us and for all of your work with ARPA Canada. We'll keep our eyes on the Supreme Court ruling, and we will keep you in our prayers. Well, that concludes our first episode of year 2018. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more stuff to think about. Ciao for now.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.